What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Daily Journey Podcast. I'm Scott Montier, your host. Glad to have you along with us on the ride. If you haven't seen any of our previous episodes, and you can go online at jamestownharborchurch.org in our sermon section. Just search Daily Podcast or Daily Journey and you'll find it there. Or just search Jamestown Harbor Church in a podcast app and you might find it there too. But let me give you a little context for my conversation today with Chelsea Van Noord. We talk a little bit about it, but Chelsea has been a person who's been in my life for most of the last decade. Started out as a college student when I was doing some college ministry, but she often refers to like our Rock Harbor experience, which before I was leading Jamestown Harbor Church, I was leading this worship venue that met at Fairhaven Church. And we were kind of in a different auditorium. It was a whole different kind of experience. It was largely smaller and informal. And that was really my first pastoral experience. And Chelsea was a key leader. There's a lot of young adults there, a lot of college students, and she was a key leader in college there and got to know her very well through that. Went on an Israel trip with her. She was on our Jamestown Harbor Church launch team initially, but then took a job in middle school ministry at Fairhaven and so kind of moved to that campus. And now is the student ministries director at our South Harbor campus. So Chelsea has a long history in her life in Harbor Churches, and it's been fun to, you know, be her friend and journey with her in that. So that's a little bit about Chelsea. The day we recorded this is sort of in the middle of the first week around George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, protests, riots, all kinds of. So you will hear that, I think, throughout this conversation. And also, I can't predict what's going to happen between the time I stop recording this and what happens when you listen to it. The context you're listening to it might be very different. I don't understand what that might be. So, you know, forgive whatever things we're omitting in that, or if it comes off, I don't know. I'm very like concerned about that now because our world changes by the day and things we say and record don't necessarily match the tone of the world in the moment. So that's really hard. So apologies for that, whatever that might mean in the future to future you. But I think we also engage that in a different kind of way through our conversation too, as people. So with all that to be said, Chelsea's a great person. Chelsea's a fantastic learner. She's a very curious person and wants to ask questions. And she plays a great role in our ministry as Harbor Churches. And for those of you who know her, we'll know that as well too. But I'm excited for you to get to know her a little bit here. So let's jump in. Here's my conversation with Chelsea Van Noord. Enjoy.
It's been a lot of like intake of information, and then it won't all fit inside. And so it just wants to all spew in different directions.
It's not all information. There's a lot of, I feel that too. And
yeah.
And what are you supposed to do with it? I mean, you heard it in our last meeting too, as we were talking. It's like, I just have all the stuff inside of me and I don't know where to go with it. And, you know, I am most scared that I'm going to make a misstep because of that.
Yeah. Oh,
either taking the wrong action or not taking the right action. You know, like I don't.
Right. We live in a culture that's afraid of offense. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how to debate well or how to enter into something. And, yeah, a lot of the stuff I've been reading this last week has been about the need to be perfect or the need to do it well is paralyzing.
Yeah,
a lot of people. And I totally can feel that and connect to it of like things I wouldn't have spoken up for because I was afraid of offending or afraid of not using the right words.
Yeah.
And now there's the, actually, we just need you to say something and be okay with being corrected. I think that's the new step for a lot of people is you like, I'm going to say something. And like today I posted my Blackout Tuesday post, but I couldn't remember the hashtag. So I did Black Lives Matter instead. Cause I was like, I know that one. I can get that one right.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes later, somebody's messaging me saying, actually like, hey, you need to change that hashtag. And my initial emotion was like anger, like how dare you call me out? And then I instantly had to go, oh wait, no, they know more than I do. And I need to be okay with being corrected. And this is like the tiniest thing.
Well, why did you have to change it?
I had to change it because, and she explained it later, like, of by using Black Lives Matter, it's actually burying, like, the educational pieces. Like, Black Lives Matter is using Instagram as an educational
tool. Sure, yeah. Well, because it's a searchable hashtag. And
right. Yeah. And if, yeah, imagine if you're looking up that information and instead you see a sea of just, like, black images.
Screens.
Yeah, black screens. It's not going to... Yeah. Right. And just the fear that people are going to stop with just a black screen and not actually, like, search out, like, black artists or black musicians or black authors, which was the intention. Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, like, your intention you have was, like, the day before my Iron Man, you know, like, I was texting back and forth with Mike Ball, who's run, like, 25 of these things, you know. And he's just like, you know, how you feeling and all this kind of stuff and preparing for the race. And Mike's not one to, like, necessarily give advice, but he's just like, the advice he gave me was, no matter what happens, just keep going forward. Right. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how often I thought about that during the race. Cause there were plenty of moments where I couldn't move forward. Right. Or when I didn't want to, like, there were moments where I just wanted to lay on the side of the ground and cry and call me up.
Right.
But in those moments, I felt like all I had to do was take another step forward. Like, it's just to keep taking. And so maybe in these moments, like you said, like, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of, like, I don't know what to do and I don't know, I'll get it wrong. And I personally feel that a lot, but I don't know, take one step forward maybe is all I can do at the moment and just be okay with that.
I think it's taking a step forward and being okay with being wrong and being called out and having to admit you're wrong and just a posture of listening, I think, is all going to be really hard for, it's hard for me. I want to rage and rage posting is a bad idea. I think that's the other thing too, of like, I like taking a breath and making sure you're not just reacting to something, that you're reading, like, who's saying it? What's the context around it? Like, where is this coming from? Like trigger posting is not a good way to enter into it either.
Well, you know, you don't have to post anything ever. There's no rule that says you have to post things on a platform.
Right. And I think
no law.
being what did someone call it? Like a keyboard activist isn't full on activism either. Like, your activism shouldn't stop with your keyboard.
It's a lot of, like, I don't know. I was having a conversation with somebody today too, and it's like, I feel like I need to say something about this, that, or the other thing. And I'm like, maybe you do. I don't know. It feels like that's actually more about you than it is about anything else. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the bigger question is, like, what's a thing that you can do? What's a conversation you can have, you know, like, to engage it. That's the thing I lament about a social media culture over the last 20 years, really, is we've sort of taught ourselves that the way forward is through a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, Jesus actually didn't do that.
Oh,
led very differently. Like, I want you to make a statement. And he writes in the dirt instead, you know, like he was very, I mean, he said things that we turn into statements too, but a lot of times those were made between him and another person. Right. Like, there were individual conversations where he spoke those things. And we think that we've got, you know, this billboard of our Twitter feed or even our Instagram or your Facebook, if that's the thing you choose. And like, well, it's calling for me to, like, make a statement on it. I'm like, I don't know if it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it tricks us to thinking maybe we did something. Maybe we made a difference.
Right. And I think, like, we're missing, like, I think I have the, like, corner real estate on truth, and somebody else thinks it too.
But they have a whole different set of experiences that got them to that corner.
And the reality is our interactions are what are actually going to bring us closer to the real truth.
Right.
And
by,
like, pushing farther and farther apart, like, we're barely getting to interact and be able to actually experience, like, real conversation and we're missing empathy from this whole thing too.
So, yeah, here's the interesting info nugget of this conversation. It was like a week or two ago or something that the senior staff at Facebook came to, like, the CEO and, like, the owners, and they basically said, the algorithms we use to determine the content that our users see are have, like, a predetermination towards divisiveness. because our number one goal is to keep your eyes on our screen as long as possible. And so the algorithms know that, and they know that what keeps you looking is divisive content. So we are predetermining that anytime a user opens up their Facebook account, they're going to experience as much divisive content as we can put forth, whether that's posted content or whether that's comments or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the CEO and the owners buried it. They said, we don't want that report getting out. We don't want to do anything with that. We think this is all good here. If that doesn't tell you that like your platforms are doing something to you.
Oh yeah.
Like I mean, it's driving you towards more division, not more conversation and interaction as you just said, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's, we're looking like negative emotion versus positive emotion.
Right?
That's why like the Some Good News thing that John Krasinski has been doing was so like out there, because it's so different than any news outlet.
Right.
Because the only things they were posting were positive things.
Yeah.
And no news outlet, like it's wild that it's even going to be picked up. And I'm so intrigued to see how it's going to change when it leaves, like it's been John Krasinski and his like dining room or wherever and his family like posting about all these things. And it's going to change when like there was no money exchanging hands besides people like helping each other. And I think it'll be really interesting when like it's going to be part of a corporation. And yeah, what changes when that happens? I don't know yet. I'm just going to be really, it'll be really intriguing to see what happens to it.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into your questions then. What are you doing to the table today?
Yeah. After all this, like just trying to figure out like, yeah, what do we talk about? And like, we've known each other for a long time. Like I've known you
How long have we? 10 years?
10 years. Yeah.
Really?
I showed up, meeting you was the most bizarre state of affairs. I don't know if you remember how we met, maybe. Well,
I would love for you to tell the story. Okay, I'm pretty great. Sure I remember.
But. Pretty sure. So a friend in college wanted to volunteer at her church. And I can't remember who I was really as a freshman and sophomore in college.
Yeah. Was this your freshman year or your sophomore year?
This is my sophomore year.
Okay.
Yeah, sophomore year of college.
Was this before or after you were crowned homecoming queen at Grand Valley?
This was before.
Before your reign as queen. Okay.
Before my reign, I had a lot of time to work on my wave. I wondered if you're going to sneak that into this conversation in some way. Yeah.
It's just me feeling like I am famous by association with someone.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my acceptance speech, I definitely named you as the.
As the driving influence.
Yeah, there was no acceptance speech.
Listen, Chelsea, you downplay this all the time. Let's just put this into perspective. In a campus of like 30,000 students, you won a popularity contest. That's impressive.
Like, I know.
Put your crown on, girl.
I did wear it on campus the day after because and my mother were like very adamant that happened. And then you made me stand up at Rock Harbor and put it on the Sunday after. It was amazing. It was really cool to see. I mean, it's a popularity contest, but to like, I had done a lot of different things with a lot of different people on campus. My community was much wider than it was deep, which I had to learn a lot about, like, how do I make good friends and not just lots of friends? But to watch people all rally to, like, there are people shouting down their, like, dorm room halls telling people to vote for me. And, like,
that's so funny.
Someone at Campus Ministries made an announcement and that, like the marching band and the honors college.
Yeah, we get it. Like I said, you won the popularity contest. Yeah,
it was, but I wouldn't have gone to Israel if that hadn't happened.
Oh, interesting.
I had like, I had $500 in my bank account and the down payment for Israel was $500 and I owed $500 for tuition.
Yeah.
So like you can't choose not to pay for your tuition. Like that's a thing you have to do. Yeah. And the scholarship you won was $500.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool.
So I literally wouldn't have gone
for that, what you owed to school, so you could do the other thing.
Yeah. I wouldn't have been able to go to Israel without that. Yeah. So God uses tiaras.
You're still just Princess Chelsea, not Princess
just Princess. Yeah, so she wanted to volunteer at her church, and she was really like nervous about going. And I don't remember why, but I was
she wanted a backup for some reason.
Wanted a backup. Yeah, she's going to meet with you, which I didn't know you yet. And I was like, I'll go with you, which I was a fairly awkward, quiet, timid person for the most part. And yeah. I think like that moment was like a huge tipping point for me as like a person.
I'm like, just, go like, meet a new person.
Yeah. And then I sat with her and you, and like, I just had never had someone listen to my ideas in the way that like you did while we were sitting there. And I was like, I want to learn about the Bible from someone who's smarter than I am. So I think I had a complex about like having a peer teach me. I'd done like a couple.
Well, because you're in the college scene and like that's how campus ministry runs, right?
Yeah. It's like, in university.
Bible study. And you were like, I'm looking for something different.
Yeah. I was like,
what did I say to that? Okay, let's do it. And then we started a Bible study at my house.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that. That's how that began.
Yeah. That's all like, that's how, I mean, I'm sure you were had other conversations with people too, but like that was a big moment of like, I have an idea and someone's like, cool, let's do it. And like, I had never had someone do that before. So that's really like shaped how I do like youth ministry now too, of like, my job is to listen to younger people and like hear their ideas. And like, even if I think they're a little nutso or they're not going to pan out or they're not really going to do anything, like those moments have actually been the best moments of youth ministry so
far. It's interesting how those moments of like, for you, it wasn't even like a step into ministry just yet, but it was the first step towards it for you. Right.
Yeah.
Like to lead in ministry, but those moments for us shape forever how we lead in ministry.
Yeah.
Because mine is the same thing. Like Chris Tooley saw me and he says, I think you should do this thing with me.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, okay, you know, uncharacteristically of me, like at that time in my life too, I was a sophomore in college or freshman in college. And he kept kind of doing that to me and for me. And I found myself in these leadership roles that at this point has now led me to, I try to see something in somebody and ask and like call them into a thing. But that one interaction has shaped all of those, like the way I do ministry from this point forward. And for you, it's like, oh, I think about how I listen to other people's ideas and try to help them do it. Right. Like, because somebody did it to me. And that's like the power we have is not just how I'm interacting with this one person, but it might be a tipping point and a shaping point for how they interact with all kinds of other people.
Yeah.
So and with all that preamble, like how do you get, how does that shape your question?
I don't remember how that connected, but it was, I wanted to talk about that. Okay. So the questions that I wanted to talk about today were, we've known each other for a long time. What are the things that like, we're connected to like what we do. And you were the first person I really met who is like a storyteller at heart, like history nerd. Like that was like my favorite things about Rock Harbor is like, you would go like, welcome to Philippians. Let's talk about Philippi. And like, you set the scene really well in a lot of different occasions and in a way that like people who aren't history nerds would enjoy also. And then like, our other interactions are like all around other nerdy things like Marvel and Star Wars. And it's fun being around people who enjoy those same stories. And you watch a lot of the same stories over and over again, like episodes 1 through 9.
I actually did watch episode 1 of Star Wars, The Phantom Menace this weekend.
It's amazing. There are people who are not going to love you for that. There's someone is going to turn off this podcast because you listen to it. My question though is, as someone who is a storyteller and engages with a lot of stories, like what to you is the difference between like a good story and like a great story?
Yeah. I'm glad you named that in me because I don't think of myself as a storyteller, right? I think of myself as a person who like, cause I can talk without story so well. Like I can talk in the abstract. I think a lot in the abstract. And I think I've just worked really hard to observe how people engage. And the more I talk in the abstract, the more they glaze over, right? So like, I mean, I've been teaching for a long time. You know, I teach middle school kids, high school kids, college kids, and then adults, you know, like I've had that. And maybe it's part of that. But I feel like I can come to such interesting like truth, I guess, whatever it is that like, oh, isn't this exciting? And I've had enough experiences where people went, no, that's not that exciting. And I'm like, why is that not true? I remember Larry Dornbos, who was the first guy I worked for after college. He was pastor at Evergreen Ministries. And I remember one time he told me, I watch it in their faces. I can be talking about the Bible. And the minute I tell them a story, their eyes light up. And I hadn't really thought much about, I think about that a lot, but I haven't said it out loud, but, oh, okay. So that's just like this, people get keyed into story. There is something about a story that makes people pay attention. And it's a way to tell the truth, communicate the truth you're trying to communicate without having to hit it on the nose. And I think that was the wrestling for me in storytelling, is to say, but I want them to get it exactly the way I want them to get it.
Yeah.
And having to learn, no, you don't, man. You want them to get it in the way they're going to get it. So, you know, my first trip to Israel was in 2005, I think, or something like that. And it's the year before Isaac was born. So yeah, it's 15 years ago. And, you know, Ray Vanderlaan was my teacher there, and he obviously is a really, really good storyteller, but told the Bible as basically one of the things he said was, every one of those things that happens in the Bible, like Jesus is like telling it to a person in a place, which are all pieces of a story, you know? So when he says, you know what, it's better to have a millstone tied around your neck and thrown into the ocean or into the sea than to cause one of these little ones who follows me like to stumble. And he says, it's probably more likely, Jesus said something like, it's better for you to have one of those tied around your neck and thrown over there as he's standing beside the Sea of Galilee next to a place where they do stonemasonry than to cause one of these guys to stumble, which is his disciples around him. Right. This is a long way to getting to the answer. I'm getting there. Like that, all that stuff sticks with me in terms of story, story, story. Like we've got, it's not about telling a story. It's not about telling a nursery rhyme, right? It's about putting something in a context that we can grasp and go, oh, if I'm in that space with them, what does that mean to me? And being okay that people hear the truth of the gospel. Or any truth, you know, which I would argue always comes down to the truth of the gospel. It's way more powerful for you to come to an aha yourself than for you to write down an aha I had. So don't teach that way, you know? And I try not to. I mean, I try to lower the amount of like smart people words I use. I mean, you took Greek this year, last year, right?
Last year.
I mean, I haven't taken Greek. I figured out a lot of Greek words. I can go and find a lot of Greek words, a lot of Hebrew words. I do take to it pretty easily, so it sticks with me. But I'd rather say, okay, what the Hebrew is telling you is this than to say the Hebrew word is this or the Greek word is this and memorize that, you know? Right. I'd rather like have you get the point of it. And at the end of the day, the thing I'm most trying to do is to do less informational context and more imagine you are this person context. So I think that's one answer to your question. What makes a good story different from a great story? A great story helps you go, I know what it feels like to be that person in the story because I've placed myself in that. It has opened a door for me to go, what's it like as that person? What's it like as Nicodemus coming to Jesus as a member of like the Jewish ruling council and all that means, you know, at a politically volatile time in relationship to Jesus, to come to Jesus one-on-one in the middle of the night so nobody sees him, but yet have some kind of, like, you must have some kind of longing, so what is it, right? Mm-hmm. Now we can connect the dots between you and Nicodemus really easily because, oh, okay, those are pieces of a story that I can kind of relate to. Right. So I think that's the difference between a good and a great story. A basic difference is there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Like, believe it or not, like, I watch preachers try to like do that. I'm going to move into a story mode. And what they do is they tell you about a story. Let me tell you about something that happened to me. And I won't tell you any of the details. I'm just going to tell you about a thing that happened to me. Right. And I think the work we need to do as pastors is we have that in our head as preachers and we got to go, oh, but what happened? What's the beginning of that story? Somebody woke up and they had this experience. Mm-hmm. And the middle of that story is what was that experience like for them? And then what was the end of it? How did that resolve? Right. And frankly, it doesn't always resolve in the way we wanted it, you know, but like we have to work to craft.
Right.
How do I enter into it? What is the, like, tell me the experiences they had from their first person point of view, or at least the second point of view, and don't interpret that for them. Because I'll tend to do that of like, well, Chelsea and I were talking and I feel like what Chelsea was experiencing in that moment was this, this, and this.
Yeah.
That's not telling you a story. It's telling you about a story. Right. So how do I like, well, Chelsea told me this is what she felt. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's the third thing I'll say is allow the ending to make whatever point the ending makes, you know, like you can see what I got out of that story and also get your own thing from a story.
Right.
You know,
do you get upset when like when they don't give you the space to figure it out on your own or.
Yeah. I think if it's, and I'm as guilty as this as anybody, and that's not a false humility. It's a very true like reality of like, yeah, we can not trust the audience or the listener, you know, if it's a one-on-one.
Right.
We can be a little didactic in how we do that. And again, go back to the earlier thing we were talking about. We feel the need for statement, don't we? Like we feel the need to make sure you know what I'm saying. And funny enough, I will get a lot more pushback and like conflict in a conversation or a sermon or anything when I'm being the most didactic and trying to be the most clear. If I just tell you a story, you're not like, we can hear each other and experience each other.
Do you think that that's why like Jesus used parables as much as he did too? Like,
I mean, maybe like it literally does say like, he wasn't like keen on everybody, like understanding everything he was saying just yet. So he told it in story so that they would be a little bit more confused. And I don't think I take that as Jesus trying to be obtuse or, you know, hierarchical or elite. I think he was saying, listen, you're going to argue about the wrong things. If I just tell this to you, you're going to miss the point. So let me help you get in the neighborhood of the point first, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Oof. That's good.
I mean, I would imagine that like you teach middle school kids, like you're a middle school youth worker, high school youth worker. This is the other big learning I had in that is biologically speaking, as a 13-year-old, as a 15-year-old, your brain cannot process abstract thinking. Ooh. Like it is very, very difficult. Here's a great example. Let me tell you a story of my 14-year-old son who sent me a text message yesterday, and it was a screenshot from him downstairs on our PlayStation. Okay. And the screenshot says, your PlayStation Plus account will be expired in 7 days. And because you have chosen to not auto renew it.
Right.
So he's like, sends me the screenshot, which he doesn't say anything because he's bad at it. He's just like, apparently he's saying, fix this. And I'm saying, oh yeah, look at the date. That was from 7 weeks ago.
Oof. Right?
And what I wanted him to get to was, and to end the story, so I'll walk you through it. That was the beginning, the middle. Now here's the end of the story. He said, yes, so, right? And so what I wanted him to get to is, dude, we had a conversation 2 weeks ago about this and you watched me renew the subscription. You can look at the date and see that it's far away. It's 7 weeks ago. And you can also recognize you're literally playing on PlayStation Plus right now. We have resolved this issue, right? So I had to walk him through that.
Right.
Because that would take some abstract connections between this very concrete moment and a moment we had 3 weeks ago.
Right.
So I think part of I don't give people the benefit of the doubt for them to connect the dots in abstract thinking. Mm-hmm. So I have to provide some concrete. And that's what I learned in doing what you're doing, right? Like you have to give kids concrete, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like
experience that.
Oh, yeah. Like I have a small group of freshmen and sophomore girls that are so much fun, like goofy and giggly, man. Like that is like all of our conversations. And we were talking about like mental health and self-care and like therapy. And I just started doing therapy and it's been like total good game job. Changer.
And all three of those words, self-help, self-care, like and therapy are abstract concepts.
Yeah, right? So abstract. Yeah. And
what does that mean? I don't know what that is.
Right. Yeah. And we're in a pandemic. So like talking to teenagers about like they're isolated and lonely and frustrated and they're bored. They're so bored and they don't know what to do with it. And so like talking about self-care, like I normally use like a car engine as the metaphor. Oh, like you have to change your oil. Yeah. Like you cannot change your oil and your engine will blow up and then you have to put it all back together, or you can change your oil every 3,000 miles. I'm like,
like 1,000. You can regularly change your oil on the schedule the engine was designed for.
Right.
Right. But if you're not doing that, you're going to run into a problem.
Right. And it's like your oil gets gunky and like you need to flush out the system sometimes. And like,
so then I'm imagining that teenagers can say like, oh, is changing the oil like staying off of social media and taking a nap and like going for a walk and all these sorts of things. Right. And you're like, yes, you got it.
Yeah. Well, but it was even better because they're mostly 15-year-olds. So like they understand like a car is basically a big version of a go-kart to a lot of them. So like number of times they've opened up and like the hood of their car. So it's like, crap, that's not going to work. So it's like, oh, it's like a filter on a fish tank. Is that like, you have to clean out the water. Otherwise the like tank goes green, like in Finding Nemo. And they're like, just like, I mean, we were on a Zoom call, so it's a little bit more difficult to engage. Yeah. But yeah, that point that Dornbos made of like their eyes lit up and they got it and they were connecting to it. So I think, it's interesting trying to find like different stories relate to different audiences and finding the right stories to not like manipulate your audience, but at least to like help them plug
It's to help them connect, you know?
Right. Like,
and here's the, and again, as a guy who does this kind of like as a big part of my job, like I'm a public speaker, I'm a communicator, both publicly and personally. Like I spend a lot of my week like talking. And one other thing that really, a memory that really sticks with me is after that first trip to Israel, like it was life changing for me because it was the first time I concretely understood what it meant to be a disciple. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
I had a season in my life growing up where I understood what it meant to be a Christian, right? Mm-hmm. And a Christian school kid. And they taught me the rules and how to be a good person and we love God. And you know, but I didn't know what that meant. My time through Young Life put me around people who knew what it meant to love Jesus. And that was brand new information to me. Right. Mm-hmm. My 2 weeks in the Holy Land and in Turkey taught me what it meant to be a disciple. And that was brand new information to me as like a 26-year-old.
Right.
And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How come nobody told me this? I've been doing this wrong. I've been missing the boat. There's so much more.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That was on your trip. That was my, I remember standing on top of Mount Arbel, looking over the Sea of Galilee going, what the heck? Like I've done this. Like, can I hit reset on everything now that I have this experience?
And so I came back and a friend of mine was on that trip with me and we were both on staff at the same time. And, you know, we had like an evening worship service that our pastor said, why don't you guys share a little bit about what you learned as the sermon part of the trip, right? And you just had this thing inside of you that was like, I have this story to tell and I have this truth to share. And I remember like boldly feeling like if I don't share this, then they are missing out, right? And like, it's so transformational. And we probably talked for about an hour and a half in a middle school gymnasium in July.
Bad idea.
Hot, right? And we both had this, like we talked about it later, like we both had this, like they're not tracking with us anymore. We've lost them, but we have to tell them. They have to know. And it was a total failure, right? They didn't hear that. They didn't understand that. They didn't go with me on that journey because they couldn't.
Right.
I was just telling them about it, right? I wasn't helping them experiencing it.
Right.
And so I don't know if you've ever had like a conversation and you feel like they're not getting it, they're not going with me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whether it's a person or a speech or whatever, it's like, now is probably the time I should stop talking that. Like, this is not, even though inside of me, I feel so passionate that they need to hear it. Passion won't take them to transformation, won't take them to change.
Yeah.
Information won't do it. I can preach way more, I mean, from one perspective, interesting sermons. I can give you a lot of more details. I can give you a lot more like words you'll never remember and I can be smarter in it. That's not going to take you there. Like, so story matters because it helps us get there and it gives it to us in pieces that we can handle.
Right. Well, and I think that's like the interesting, like I was at Rock Harbor for most, like almost all the time that you were there, like to the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a lot of sermons. So you definitely shared the same story more than one time.
Totally.
Like there were totally times where I was like, oh, I know where he's going with this. But it was because like the same story can still, like there are more layers than just the like the top layer. Like we need to hear stories again and again and again. Like there's a reason that like the Michael Jordan story hasn't ended. Like the Last Dance.
Are you kidding me? It's been 20 years.
Right. We're still talking about
fascinated by it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I haven't, like, full disclosure, I haven't watched it yet. I will. Yeah. I promise. Yeah. But I wanted to make sure the audience.
Back to what you said before too, Star Wars, right? Like Marvel, like all of these things that are ubiquitous in our culture. I mean, how does my kid who's 8, you know, has never seen a minute of a Star Wars anything, know that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's dad? He knows, right?
Yeah.
Like it's because there's things in story that like grab us and still do something inside of us, no matter how many times we've seen it.
Right. And I think like to like talking about you being a storyteller, I think like the context piece is actually how you tell stories really well, because you fill in gaps in the story that are confusing.
Sure.
Like,
or that we'll just skip over, but actually can enrich the story.
Right. Absolutely. Like I'm watching through the Clone Wars series for the first time ever right now. And it's like a little kid show and it's a cartoon. And I rolled my eyes through the first two seasons, but now I'm in the end and I'm like, they're putting together all these pieces that were confusing and I'm losing it every time because like those context pieces are actually there and like you've lived with the story. And I think like that's especially like in
like you to realize there's a bigger story going on.
Yeah.
And it was here the whole time. And I think the Bible is that way too. Right. Like there's a bigger story here in this text. And even if I just read the footnotes in my study Bible, I'll find it, you know?
Right. But, yeah. Like you're talking about like, so many context pieces. So yes, you are a really good storyteller. There you go.
Well, thank
Scott Puntier.
And you're welcome. Like, you know, to put the cultural moment on it as well, like that's the thing that's resonated with me the most in terms of like race riots and Black Lives Matter and all this kind of stuff is to realize, I mean, for me more than I ever have of partly because I'm so sick of statement, you know, like that's just been, we've had 5 years of making statements about whatever and it doesn't matter anymore and all that kind of stuff. But like to realize, Martin Luther King said riots are the language of the unheard, right?
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing is it's not that people are not being unheard for their statement. They're not being, they're being unheard for their story.
Yeah.
So the moment we have now is to engage in people's stories and to say, I didn't connect to your story. I didn't realize that was the story you were living while I was over here living this story. I think we're better if we do that.
And I like, that's the, like the story of me like entering ministry is I grew up in a church community that like women in ministry was like a statement of like, we are against it. And then it was a mentor of my dad's like daughter going through seminary and like the human element is what changed it from statement to why does this matter?
Yeah.
And then
there
was
a story, right?
Yeah. There was an actual, like there's a story with a real person involved. And now like my parents are so supportive, but that took them and like still me doing internal work of like, there was a time when like I interpreted the Bible as this being sinful.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, no, like we need all the voices to be able to help us experience like God and scripture and like where Jesus is going.
I mean, if the Bible, if you're going to come to my church on a Sunday morning and experience me telling you the story of a person in the Bible and go, wow, this biblical story is so much bigger than I thought. How much more like is the spiritual story you're living in like engrossed by really connecting with like the story of a person who's not like you?
Right.
You know, well, like and experiencing their journey. Right.
Yeah. Well, and just like what voices are telling, I think, storytelling is important and what voices are telling it. Like I never heard or never experienced a female pastor until I was in college. And I was like, this is different. And like different feels wrong the first time you experience different. And like, we have to like move. And that's how I felt the first time.
Here's the thing that female preachers say to me all the time is most people are like, I don't like the idea of a female preacher, but I like you. Right.
Yeah.
Like they experience that all the time. And it's like, oh, that's because it's about the story and about the person, like individually engaging with it, not the statement of this is good or bad. Right.
Right. Well, and then to talk to students who are experiencing female pastors and they're like, that's just normal. So I think part of it is like, if we're not normalizing something and like when you're a kid and when you're like able to like grow and understand it and connect with it in a different way, like, of course it's going to feel different and uncomfortable. And like, how do we, tell really good story, or tell stories that matter and have like empathy and connectivity, but then also make sure there are multiple voices like telling those stories too.
Yeah. And again, every story like enriches the whole, the larger story. And you know, most of us live in a world where we listen to one kind of story, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What's your next question?
Cool. Well, that was a lot of the thing. Well, so I'm going to mix a couple of them together just because this has been like good. What's the story you hope your, so I know your kids love them. They're great. My favorite story of Isaac is I came to babysit them when they were like 3 and 4, which is kind of terrifying to think of 10 years ago. And, you guys were leaving, but I really was like connecting. Cindy and I were chatting, and I remember Isaac going like, "Man, Mom, I'm itching for you to go, but I don't know what that means." And just like using words you didn't know yet. It was like still my all-time favorite Isaac moment. What is the story you hope they are going to tell like 10 years from now, looking back on like quarantine and corona and what's happening right now, especially like in this last week, of like, what's the story that you like hope that they're gonna speak to about either just this in general or about like you and Cindy, like when they think about like what was dad like or mom like, what's the story you're...
I don't know, I mostly feel like I'm doing it terribly as it is, but if there's an answer to that, I like, at the end of the day, I hope it's like that pain has a purpose, like, and not to be afraid of that. I don't know. We try not to, we try not to shield them too much. I have this weird relationship because I do try to shield them from the church stuff too much, 'cause I'm scared that they'll resent it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. 'Cause I'm scared that they'll look at, I can't talk. I mean, Jonah came to the door a little while ago, like the slider door here. And I was like, I had to put up a hand and say, I'm in the middle of a call here. Like, and that's the hard part about like quarantine has been, I have to do my work here, which in some ways, you lose either way, because it's like, well, if I'm gone, they resent the fact that I'm not around because my work has taken me there, right? But here, it's like, I'm around but not available. Is that worse? I don't know.
Right,
But I feel like, so like I have a lot of like, I try not to bring the leadership tensions that I'm experiencing, you know?
Right.
Like this week, I've done it a little bit more. I was playing a game of Settlers of Catan and Isaac's like, "Dad, come on, be here. Right. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I just got an email that made me really sad about, you know, that somebody had sent me and about a conflict or whatever. And I'm like, immediately like, this is stuff. My job doesn't go home. Right. Like it's always making me, it can take like a nasty email. Like, and it's not nasty. Just like, I take that back. Rewind that. A conflict, which is normal, like takes emotional energy from me.
Yeah.
My kid can see it. And now I'm trying to process that out loud a little bit more to help, because they're 14 and 13 now. They can understand a little bit about like, why did I just like vacate the game a little bit? Why did I just, why do I feel the way? So I'm trying to explain to them a little bit more about why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? Like last night we had a conversation about like, you don't know this, but there's protests going on in cities across the country right now. And here's why. And, and that sort of thing. And that's like step one in a conversation. Step two in a like at some point is, you know, you shared a video not too long ago about African Americans talking to their children about like stuff I don't have to talk to my kids about. And I want them to experience that with me and to have a conversation about that. And to say, I want their eyes to be open to a wider, to the wider pain in the world. I mean, whether that's race or whether that's politics or whether that's church or whether that's just global pandemic, which nobody has a category for.
Yeah.
I'm hesitant to want to shield them from it, but I also really am hesitant to like, if you, I mean, parents do this all the time. I'm not going to talk about it with her right now. 'Cause what if it just goes away and then I don't have to deal with it anymore. And then they're living in the world that they think is fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm feeling more and more burdened to help them see like, there's a lot of pain and brokenness going on. How do I make that have purpose?
Right. Yeah. And I think like, I mean, I don't have kids. I'm single. So I'm not like engaging with like teenagers in the same way. I'm like talking to them as like their friend and their pastor, not as their like mom or dad or like,
and I want more people to do that with my kids.
Right. But I think, it's, you're having like no big conversation should be just one big conversation. It should be 1,000 little conversations. And I think, like opening their eyes like to those things and like, you admitted to your son, like, I'm sad because something happened, and like, that's giving him permission to know that it's okay to feel emotion. And yeah. I don't think, especially for like, especially teenage boys, like we don't give mm-hmm. them space to know that it's okay to be sad or mad, or like, there's just so much like, push your emotions down, like yeah. go full, like Elsa, conceal, don't feel. And yeah, you're giving space by being real in front of them. And I mean, yeah, there are things you should shield them from, but you're yeah. also going like,
but the trick is like knowing when and how to do that. Right. Because the other problem is like, we know these people better than any other human on the planet. Like, I know this kid. And right. you do the mental arithmetic that says, if I say this or say it like that, they're going to respond like this, and then we're going to lose the mm-hmm. track, right? Like,
right.
I get that all the time. I mean, Jonah kind of keeps it – there's some stuff he keeps out all the time, and it's super, like, annoying, you know? Right. Keep that in for a minute, you know? And right. then there's a lot of things where he's just, like, not even thinking through.
Yeah.
Isaac will think through everything all the time, and it's exhausting.
Right.
It's like, dude, you don't need to think through that anymore. And so how do I balance a narrative that's like, dude – feel your feelings, but you don't need to like obsess over them. Like, you don't need to understand.
Yeah.
And then also like, hey, you should pay attention to what's going on inside yeah. of you. Like, oh boy, parenting's yeah. hard because of that.
Right? Sounds right. And I think it's like, it's constant checking in yeah. whatever way that looks for your family. Like
yeah.
assuming that they're okay, or assuming that they're connecting with something, like assuming.
I use the language of like, thing. I'm just trying to keep the bridge open.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming that the conversation I'm about to have is going to fail, right?
Right.
Like, I'm going to try. It's not going to go well. And you name the topic, and that's what it is. But I'm going to try again, and that'll – but yeah. eventually, like, we'll have built a bridge of this conversation right. where it doesn't matter if it's going good right. or bad. We can just yeah. always have it.
Yeah. And you don't start with the hardest part either. Like, you start with, like, the smaller pieces. You start yeah. with the, like, hey, that happened. How did that make you feel? Or
sometimes it's like, did you know that that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah, it's my friends and I are reading through the book White Privilege or White Fragility, and it's so good. Like, that's my, like, that's my action step in all of this so far, is like reading yeah. and learning. And a lot of that book is her doing that. It's her pointing out, did you know this is like a segment of white privilege? And we're all sitting there going, that's how new. The world yeah. that's new. What do I do with that? And like, as an adult, like being able to like manage that and process it. But yeah, as a teenager, like
yeah.
your emotions are already like all over the place, and hormones, and just like learning, like you're restructuring how you view the world. So
yeah, I wonder at what point I feel like we live in a culture right now that is desirous of certainty instead of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's, yeah. I mean, Scott, when are we going to do this with the church service? I'm like, I don't know. Like, right. honestly, I have no better answer than that. Right. Well, mm-hmm. when are we going to do this? Or like, that's the statement kind of culture, right? Of like, yeah. it's about certainty.
Yeah.
But like, boy, there's so much we don't know. Like, you're reading that right. book and you're like, oh, I didn't even know. Or you walk through an experience in Israel and you're like, I didn't know that the Bible was that concrete, or that like the story of Barjel Pixner puts it best. He says there are five gospels of Jesus Christ, five yeah. stories of his life on earth. Four of them are written down. One of them is the land in which it took place. Right.
Right.
And so like, we're so much better when we cultivate a curiosity about, oh, there's more to the story, or there's a different side of a story, or there's extra mm-hmm. stories that I'm not experiencing. And
yeah.
it's tough balance of when to protect your kids yeah. and when to encourage their like curiosity into those stories, because when they find them, they're not going to know how to process them, and it's going to be painful, and it's going to, you know, mm-hmm. like it's yeah. tough.
Yeah. And I think that goes past just teenagers and like into adults too, like yeah. in this whole experience of like this past week and riots and protests, like fostering curiosity in people and going like, hey, like, we don't have the corner real estate on knowing what this is or how to respond to it, but like,
yeah,
just helping people be curious and then like walking with them and listening and yeah, doing what you did for me when I was a like 19-year-old and going, I think this would be a cool thing to do. And like following people and like encouraging their, where their heart is like passionate, well, like, yeah, their passions. And, yeah.
and I think that curiosity begets empathy.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're kind of all over the map these days emotionally. And like, I was talking to one pastor friend and he's so frustrated with how people are responding and reacting and angry. And, you know, some of it's people in his church, some of it isn't, but he's like, I feel like I need to condemn this and say that, and, you know, and I'm like, maybe, I don't know. But I'm also reminded that all of those things come from a place inside somebody else's story too. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are angry about something, like or if they're responding this way, that come, like, I think the better move is to be more curious about where that comes from and to journey with them too. Like,
yeah,
we can't just choose who we're going to journey with. That's part of the problem.
Right.
Like, we have to be committed to being curious and willing to journey with all of the people who are around us, especially the ones we don't disagree or the ones we don't agree with.
Yeah.
And even though the ones we don't agree with might be the people who look most like us sometimes.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and being committed to that space, and then just the, like, not just living in the surface, and yeah, knowing, like, the way Jesus interacted with everybody was to ask a question, yeah, to their question, and know that, like, we all have underlying questions that we just need to live in space with people for us to be able to even get there with them.
The most transformational thing somebody told me about being a disciple is that, and I've said this to you, I'm sure, but a disciple's job was not to become an expert, but to become a beginner. Best disciple was the one who figured out how to ask the best and most questions. Right. Which, if you are asking the most questions, it means you can look like the dumbest person in the room. But that's the higher value of a disciple, mm-hmm, is not to be the dumbest person in the room, but the most curious, the most, I don't have this figured out yet. I'm not certain. I have much more to learn. I want to be different. Right.
Yeah. And yeah, the most willing to be corrected, the most willing to go, like, I don't know. And you're going to, like, you're going to say something that's not true. It's like I, as a kid, thought that Rudy was the best football player of Notre Dame history ever.
Right, yeah.
And was, like, sticking to my story until someone was like, hey, you got to actually, like, watch that movie. And it was the most heartbreaking moment ever of, like, oh, just kidding. Yeah. And, like, how do
you're going to have a real rude awakening when you finish The Last Dance. Michael Jordan was kind of a jerk.
No. Yeah. But it's like, we put ideas and people on pedestals, and we have to be okay with, like, two of my top heroes as a teenager were Oscar Pistorius, who was the South African, like, double paraplegic. Also, there's, like, a weed whacker outside my door. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Good. Oscar Pistorius and Lance Armstrong. Like, I am so used to my idols, like, disappointing and going, like, okay.
It's like, for us to just take ourselves off of that pedestal first.
Right.
And go, I can learn something.
I think that's the big movement. I think for, like, me personally, I think for especially, like, the, like, white church and just our culture in general needs to take ourselves off the pedestal and go, what can we be curious about? And like, how can we say, hey, I was wrong, or I'm sorry, I didn't know. Like, how can we move forward?
Well, there you go. I hope my kids learn that this season.
I think they will.
Well, thanks for being on today. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Cool. Yes, I'll continue to give you the credit for my homecoming tiara. No problem.
That's fine. I keep it in my resume too. So
good. All right. Good to know. Jesse. Bye, Scott.